G'day, it's Stephen Darley here with a piece of the action for this week in early December. I had my hair cut because I thought it was getting warmer, but it's got cold again, isn't it? The show today is going to be about the possibility of a new war in the Middle East, unfortunately. But before we go on with that, I'd like to acknowledge that we're on Kaurna land and that Kaurna sovereignty has never been relinquished, and that we respect the spiritual beliefs of the Kaurna people and the Kaurna elders. We thought, whether you like it or not, that the wars in the Middle East, or the main war in the Middle East in Syria, was dying down. But with the defeat of ISIS and the close to defeat of Al-Qaeda, with their many names, in Syria. But unfortunately, that's may not be the case. The Yemen war, of course, continues, and that's a bloody and murderous war. Saudi Arabia and its Gulf allies invading and attacking and bombing Yemen, one of the poorest countries in the world. But there's also a new war brewing, again involving Saudi Arabia. And what it involves is a peculiar alliance. It involves an alliance between Saudi Arabia and Israel. You may not think that's likely. The ultra-conservative Sunni Muslim monarchy of Saudi Arabia and the ultra-conservative Zionist and apartheid state of Israel. But in fact, the principle involved here is the enemy of my enemy is my friend. And that relationship has been building for several years, even though there's no formal recognition of Israel in Saudi Arabia. And the chief enemy, of course, is Iran. And of course, the two are backed by the United States in this process. So far, the United States, although it's been making threats, is not willing to attack Iran itself. But they are now seemingly willing to sic Saudi Arabia and Israel onto Iran and their allies. Those allies being Hezbollah and Lebanon, Syria possibly, Qatar, which although a Sunni Muslim monarchy is also much more open to relationships with the Iranians, being a very close neighbor in the Persian Gulf, and also has been under blockade for some months by Saudi Arabia for that very reason. Turkey may even be drawn in because they have 30,000 troops helping to guard Qatar from possible invasion. And they've been building more and more relationships with the Iran-Syrian alliance. And of course, Russia may well be drawn in because they're an ally of Syria and getting more or less building an alliance with Iran as well. So it's a tangled web, and unfortunately it may bring, in the end, the two biggest nuclear powers on Earth into direct confrontation with each other. But at the moment, it's more to do with their allies. This audio is actually about the what's been called by Pepe Escobar, the left-wing journalist, the Saudi Night of Long Knives, which is part of the preparation for this possible war. It involved the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, Salman, who is the effective ruler, basically taking out 11 other princes, his cousins, of rival branches of the Saudi royal family, which is very large. Supposedly as a champion of moderation and against corruption, but it's really about a power play because he's managed to extort some $800 billion dollars out of these princes by some reports, according by use of torture. But here we go with Pepe Escobar talking to Russia Today about that issue.
Let's discuss this further now and cross live to speak to independent geopolitical analyst Pepe Escobar. Thank you for joining us on the programme. Now, what do you think could be behind this sudden and unexpected anti-corruption drive?
No, it's not unexpected. In fact, Trump, the only thing that he said that applies is that Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman, which we call MBS, knows exactly what he's doing, which is an old-style purge, or what I call the night of the Saudi long knives, where he got rid of any potential high-profile contender against his one-man rule. Don't forget, Saudi Arabia has, they don't have an independent judiciary, they don't have freedom of expression, they don't have a credible opposition, and in fact, King Salman is not ruling. Who's ruling is actually MBS. So, a few days before, in fact, 2 weeks before the night of the long knives, there was a famous Davos in the Desert conference where the new crown prince, in fact, and the new leadership was plugging the future of Saudi Arabia as envisioned 2030, which implies a lot of investment or ultra high profile, especially American investors. We're talking about Larry Flink. We're talking about Steven Schwarzman. And a few days later, Jared Kushner was in Riyadh, where he's bonding, and he has been bonding very closely with the crown prince. The next day, there was the night of the long knives. Trump said that Aramco share should be floated at the New York Stock Exchange. What I get from some of my best sources, with they have been doing business deals with the House of Saud for decades, in fact, is that the underlying narrative is a deal between Jared Kushner and MBS personally. Trump has kept his hands off in this whole matter. This involves a new foreign policy that is very complex and especially antagonizing Iran and Lebanon, which is the second part of our discussion.
Well, the big question is, what's going to happen next? Do you think that the clan war between the royals could escalate after the Crown Prince's actions? And if so, how?
It is escalating. Absolutely. It has already escalated because in the middle of all this melee, when we have the jail at the Riyadh, Ritz-Carlton, Lebanese Prime Minister Saad Hariri going on Saudi television, reading a declaration written by the Saudis and abdicating from his post of Prime Minister in Lebanon, which is completely absurd. And the president of Lebanon, Michel Aoun, said, no, we don't buy that. We try to intermediation with France, the Brits, Jordan, Egypt. It didn't work. And now they're expecting Hariri to go back to Lebanon. So this is ratcheting up an intimidation of Lebanon because for the MBS crowd, there is a direct conflation between Hezbollah and the Lebanese government. Mm. So I've talked to a lot of the best Middle East political analysts, and we all agree the next step is Saudi Arabia ratcheting up war against Lebanon. And this is a very, very serious development.
Okay, independent geopolitical analyst Pepe Escobar, thank you for your time.
Yes, and if in case you didn't catch it, Jared Kushner that he was talking about there is the son-in-law of President Trump and his effectively his Middle Eastern envoy being used seemingly in replacement for Secretary of State Tillerson, who may be for the high jump, according to some news. Now, you still might say, what's this got to do with us? Well, apart from the fact that it's bringing war to, or the possibility of war to one of the most war-torn regions in the world, and possibly bringing the two superpowers into confrontation, or the two major nuclear powers, I should say. Australia is involved in at least supporting the Saudis, possibly even in the blockade of Yemen. I'll get back to that later, but please bear in mind that. Now, I also need to talk about the background to this. This is about geopolitics, but also geoeconomics. The trend, as you all know, for the last few years has been for China to becoming economically more and more powerful and the United States to be becoming less so. But one of the key elements of dispute between them is the control of, or at least the key decisions relating to the most important commodity in the world, oil. The oil has been trading in the so-called petrodollar, i.e. in American dollars, for decades now, and that's a critical support for American economic domination. But China and Russia and increasingly some of the BRICS states, Brazil and Russia, India and China and other countries like Iran have been evolving an alternative to that, the so-called petro-yuan. And this is something that's seen as America as a great threat to them. Saudi Arabia is a key element in the petrodollar, of course, being the biggest oil producer in the world. And the Americans have therefore need the Saudis, despite the fact that the Saudis need the Americans even more. They're not a popular monarchy. They're, apart from their medievalist policies, they rule over a very large Shiite minority who happen to be mostly in the oil-bearing districts or in the main oil-bearing districts of Saudi Arabia. There's no sign, a whisper of democracy in Saudi Arabia. It's a complete absolutist state. Therefore, they need the Americans militarily and politically. But Salman's ambitious. He's already made a number of initiatives to expand Saudi power in the region, although they, so far there have been spectacular failures. I'm talking about the Yemen war, where although a great deal of suffering has taken place, a great deal of death, they have not met their military or political objectives at all. I'm talking about the attack on Qatar, which has not made Qatar back down. And as I said, has brought in Turkey on their side. And I'm talking about also the one you heard Pepe Espar talking about, the virtual kidnapping of the Saudi Prime Minister, who, as Pepe Espar said, was very strange indeed that the Prime Minister of a country announces his resignation in a press conference in another country. Quite clearly he was under coercion, but he has now been returned to Lebanon through French mediation, has repudiated his resignation. And what seems to have happened is that Hezbollah has now got the most of the various forces in the Lebanon, which is a very complex, the small country, behind him. The president, Michel Aoun, who's a Christian, has said this was a kidnapping of their prime minister. The head of the Lebanese army, who's the brother of Michel Aoun, has talked about the Israeli enemy and repelling any invasion of Lebanon. So, again, this seems to have backfired. The latest venture has also been involved a betrayal of the Palestinians, a plan that was evolved in Israel, shared with the Saudis and taken up by them, which basically meant that the Saudis would no longer support the Palestinians unless they gave in to an even more extreme version of the oppression they're now under, a Palestinian state confined to Gaza Strip and a few enclaves, Bantustans, if you will, in the West Bank. Giving up the right of return, basically everything the Palestinians have been fighting against for years, in return for continuing Saudi subsidies, which obviously have been threatened to be cut off by the Saudis if this didn't happen. Now, the Palestinian Authority leader Abbas went to Saudi Arabia recently, and this was presented to him. But when he got back to Palestine, he repudiated and said, "We can't." I mean, he wouldn't have survived as a leader if he had agreed to that. So again, the bullying has not worked for Saudi Arabia. The other element in this is that the war, if it occurs, would draw in Hezbollah as an ally of Iran, probably Syria, because Hezbollah has been fighting alongside the Syrian government forces. As I said, possibly Turkey, and possibly Russia. And China has now reportedly been sending special forces to Syria to help with the defeat of Islamic insurgents, and particularly those that are also associated with insurgency in Western China, in the Uzbek country. Yeah, what a mess. What a mess. I think it's important that we bring to bear the American role in this. So the latest, this is some audio from a American show called The Young Turks, and Ryan Grimm is the reporter talking about the situation with a recent Congress vote on Saudi and Iran.
So the United States Congress last night, against its better judgment apparently, finally, after 2 years of resisting pressure to do so, took a vote on the war in Yemen. Now, this was the result of an effort pushed by California Congressman Ro Khanna, who has been demanding that Congress vote up or down on whether or not to authorize the U.S. involvement in the Saudi-led war in Yemen. He introduced a privilege resolution, along with Walter Jones, a Republican from North Carolina who's often involved in a lot of anti-war efforts. And they used a provision in what's called the War Powers Act, which says that if there is a conflict that involves the United States, a resolution to get authorization for that conflict is privileged and cannot be blocked by leadership and must come to the House floor for a vote. Well, you can do whatever you want. In the law, the House of Representatives kind of does what it wants, because everything has to go through the Rules Committee before it gets to the floor of the United States of the U.S. House. And so in the Rules Committee, they had the ability to strip the privilege status away from this resolution. And so Khanna negotiated with Steny Hoyer, who was a member of Democratic leadership who was pushing against the idea of having this vote, as well as the Republican leadership that also did not want to have this vote. And they came up with a compromise that that came to the floor last night. The resolution that was voted on last night is quite a bizarre one. This is a Saudi-led war that the U.S. is involved with, and the Congress is now on record condemning Iran for this war. Yes, that's right. The United States Congress is condemning Iran for the Saudi-led war. Their justification for that is that the Iranians have helped fund and provide weapons to the Houthi rebels. What they don't mention is that when the Houthis took Sana'a, the capital of Yemen, back in April of 2015, the U.S. intelligence community had intercepts showing that the Iranian government pressed the Houthis not to go into Sana'a. They did not think this war was a good idea. But there is a faction of the foreign policy elite in Washington and around this country that believes that Iran is all-powerful across the Middle East, and that anything that Hezbollah or Hamas or the Houthis or anywhere, any Shia in Iraq do, must be the work of their puppet masters in Tehran. Very specifically, we intercepted communications between the Iranians and the Houthis, the Iranians saying, don't go into Sana'a, don't do this. This is an escalation of this conflict that is not useful for you, and we would advise you against it. They went in anyway. The Yemeni government collapsed, and the leader fled to Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia then launched this put together this coalition and has been bombing the hell out of Yemen for the last two and a half years. The U.S. has been helping with the targeting under the Obama administration and under the Trump administration, helping with the targeting and helping to refuel the bomber jets in midair so that they can do that much more bombing. So that is the conflict that the United States Congress last night said we're going to condemn Iran for. Otherwise, in the resolution, it said that they would like to see a political settlement to the dispute, rather uncontroversial statement. And the most controversial thing politically that the resolution contained, and this was the little piece that Khanna was able to win, was a statement by Congress that they have not authorized the war in Yemen. So think about that. So the resolution says Congress has not authorized war in Yemen. Yesterday the war was going on in Yemen. Today the war is going on in Yemen. Tomorrow the war is going on in Yemen. In other words, Congress voted to prove to the world how feckless and powerless it is. Just to put on paper that they have not authorized this thing that is going on regardless of their lack of authorization. Now, Congress does have power to rein it in if they want to. They could cut off funding for the war. They could pass something that says that not only is it not authorized, but that U.S. cooperation with this war must end. They could even, I don't know, suggest that the U.S. do something to alleviate the suffering that the U.S. and Saudi-led war has caused. And so the geopolitics and the politics of this are confusing. And so if you have any questions about it, put them in the comment section. Eric can read them out to me. Before I get to this, so Chris Murphy on the Senate floor today is Tuesday, brought photos of children, Yemeni children, who are starving and dying as a result of the war. An unusual thing for a United States senator to do. And in his speech, he was very precise about the complicity of the U.S. in this ongoing slaughter that is approaching a genocide. But what exactly is going on? So Yemen has somewhere near 25 to 30 million people. This is not as small a country as you may think it is. Just recently, the Saudi-led bombing campaign took out the airport in Sana'a. They previously have taken out the electric grid. Since they have also taken out basically all of the infrastructure, the roads, the refineries, anything that can be used to create electricity or power. The water treatment plant in the capital city is no longer working, both because the electric grid is down and because they can't get fuel over the roads in there. They now can't fly into the city either. They also have launched a blockade of the country, a naval blockade of the country. So humanitarian assistance that was going to people who are starving and dying can no longer get to them. There are now a million people in Yemen who have been diagnosed with cholera, which is one of, and Murphy talks about this disease in his floor speech today. It is one of the worst possible ways that you can imagine dying. You basically vomit yourself to death. It is a human caused disease, and it can be easily cured by humans as long as people get basically water that has been treated effectively. If you don't have water that's treated effectively, you're going to have a massive cholera outbreak, which happened in Haiti, and which people are worried about happening in Puerto Rico if the power doesn't get up and if people don't have access to clean water. So on top of the million people that have been diagnosed with cholera, you have millions who are starving. So you now have no way to get ships, no way for ships to dock and to bring food in. The roads are destroyed. The airports are destroyed. The electrical grid is destroyed. People are already dying by the thousands, And if something doesn't change, it's going to go into the hundreds of thousands and into the millions. A catastrophe of just absolute historic and epic proportions being led by Saudi Arabia with the United States, with the help of the United States government. And last night, the Congress of the United States voted to condemn Iran for this.
Right. Can you talk about how the United States is helping to wage right. war in Yemen?
So the principally two ways. I mean, one, just the political support of Saudi Arabia is one way that the U.S. is helping this. This is a coalition that involves the United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia, and the United States, so that we're part of this coalition. Precisely, we're helping with targeting. In other words, Saudi Arabia will say, well, we want to bomb X, and we will say, well, you should hit this point if this is where you want to bomb. Now, Trump administration officials don't even bother to try to defend this practice. Trump recently said that Mohammed bin Salman, the crown prince of Saudi Arabia, the architect of this, knows exactly what he's doing. What he's doing is committing war crimes, but Trump says he knows exactly what he's doing. The Obama administration at least tried to defend its involvement in this by saying that if they weren't helping targeting these bombing raids, that they would be much more indiscriminate and that they would kill many more civilians, and so that their involvement was minimizing harm and an attempt to kind of rein in this headstrong, arrogant, then 30-year-old Mohammed bin Salman, now 32-year-old. And the second way is refueling. These jets can only bomb so much if they can't refuel in the air, and the United States is very sophisticated in these refueling operations. And then the third is the obvious one. These fighter jets and these bombs didn't come from nowhere. They were produced by American weapons makers and sold to the Saudis by the United States.
Okay, so Dylan Pruitt is wondering about what happened with the Lebanon prime minister. Was he kidnapped? Is he speaking on his own, or is he a hostage?
I think you have to say that he was, at this point, that he was kidnapped. If he is not free to hold press conferences and to travel around the world like a normal leader of a country, then you have to conclude until you get other evidence that he was kidnapped. So you're talking about a guy named Saad Hariri, who is, you could say, is the prime minister of Lebanon, or resigned as the prime minister of Lebanon. But the story is this, that very recently he was in a meeting with some French diplomats, and he got a call on his cell phone. His demeanor changed entirely. He left the meeting, got on a plane, flew to Saudi Arabia. When he got to Saudi Arabia, according to Robert Fisk, his cell phone was taken immediately. And he then did a kind of like hostage-like statement saying that he's resigning as the prime minister of Lebanon. I mean, think about it. This is a prime minister of a country who is summoned to Saudi Arabia, forced to resign, and then he's now apparently in a very luxurious house arrest in Saudi Arabia. Now, the background on this guy is that he is the younger son of Rafiq Hariri, who was assassinated in around 2005. And Rafiq had anointed his son to be the kind of his political heir. Like many of these dynasties, he doesn't have the charisma and the political talent that his father did, but he did have his wealth. These are billionaires who are deeply invested in the in real estate and construction trade, and with backing from Saudi Arabia. Saad Hariri, in many ways, is Saudi. Like he's Lebanese, his father's Lebanese, but he very much grew up and was educated in Saudi Arabia. The company that he ran for a very long time, he was Saudi backed. It recently went, one of his biggest companies recently went bankrupt. The politics here are that Mohammed bin Salman is, as we've said, people call him some people in Saudi Arabia in the circle there call him a sociopath, but he's somebody who's like headstrong is the word that people use in articles as a kind of a euphemism for that, impulsive, erratic. So you could see somebody with those characteristics making a snap decision like that. According to the reporting, Mohammed bin Salman, who goes by MBS, had decided that Hariri was no longer able to rein in Hezbollah. And Hezbollah is this as a proxy for Iran. MBS despises everything Iran and wants to challenge Iran. Now, the idea that Hariri could rein in Hezbollah is a little bit fanciful. Hezbollah has kind of like a veto power. They don't run Lebanon, but they have sort of like a veto authority in Lebanon. And Lebanon's politics are famously dysfunctional. And there was this great, it wasn't an Onion, but it's like the Middle East version of the Onion. There was this great article that they did where the Islamic State like takes over Lebanon, but then can't figure out how to like put a cabinet together and can't figure out how all the different factions work together, and eventually they just leave Lebanon because it's like an ungovernable mess. And so Hariri had put together a government with the support of Hezbollah and the rest of the factions, and now that's all been thrown out. Kuwait, Bahrain, and Saudi Arabia have all advised their citizens to leave Lebanon, which is always an ominous sign if you're Lebanese. Why are these countries that are rattling the saber at us advising their people to get out? What's coming next? The odd alliance between Saudi Arabia and Israel plays into this too, as there's been a lot of speculation that Saudi Arabia is kind of doing Israel's bidding here in challenging Hezbollah. That's what's going on with Hariri. The other irony is that Hadi, if you remember the Yemeni president who was forced out by the Houthis and fled to Saudi Arabia, is himself now under house arrest in Saudi Arabia. So the Saudis, not only did they round up and arrest a bunch of their own royal family members and officials in the media and business elsewhere, they have two leaders from the region in house arrest in their own country. The hell's going on?
Michaela Islam would like to know, what is the purpose of this? What is the payoff? Because 1 million people are dead. It's a damn high price to pay for whatever it is. And I want to add, is there anything in it for the United States?
The only thing in it for the United States is to keep in the good graces of the Saudis who are running it. The Saudis are kind of the linchpin of the petrodollar system, and so the U.S. wants to keep Saudi Arabia close. Now, for bin Salman, the political objective was to show that he was a tough guy. He was named basically Minister of Defense a couple years ago, and this was his 30-year-old kid, and so this was his way. Or he thought that this was going to be his way of winning support of the people and showing that he's actually a true leader and deserves his rightful place as the future king. He thought he was going to take this Saudi this trillion-dollar Saudi military and wipe the floor with these Houthi rebels. Instead, the Houthis have made gains for the most part, and he has kind of only embarrassed himself. The Iranians have helped out to some degree now that Saudi Arabia is mired in this muck. The Iranians are happy to kind of send some logistical help and some weaponry over to the Houthis to continue the quagmire as long as the Saudis are going to stay in it. But if he was trying to show how tough they are, that absolutely did not work, because despite the fact that he's killing people through disease and starvation, they've made basically no progress militarily. And we have a leaked email from that relays his own opinion on this. He was talking to two foreign policy experts in the United States who relayed that conversation to Yusuf Alataba, whose inbox was hacked and emails were provided to us. And he told Ben Salman told them he thinks that they're losing the war. It's a disaster, and he wants to get out, but he doesn't know how to get out without losing face. That's precisely the position that the United States found itself in with Vietnam, and that many governments find themselves in. That they recognize intellectually that they're losing, but they can't wrap their heads around a way to get out without their egos getting hurt. And so millions more die before they finally figure out how to leave.
So working back to what happened in the Senate today, there's a question about, it's just basically infuriated by the pictures of the children starving. Could anything come from, can our Congress do anything? Do we have any reason to hope, or did we just...
I mean, Congress can keep forcing media attention on this. Maybe George Clooney starts to pay attention. That's how the world started focusing on Sudan. It would be very hard for Clooney to even get into Yemen at this point. But we might be approaching a place where more people are starting to care about this, because the scale of the death and the misery and disease is becoming almost too much to ignore. Then again, we might find out that our ability and a capacity to ignore suffering that we're causing is higher than we thought it was.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. It's the we're causing part. You know, I mean, I saw a story on PBS last night about me.
Yeah. Pretty depressing, especially if you're Yemenis, the war that's going on there. And as I said earlier, Australia has some involvement in this. Some of it is about training the Saudi Navy, but also noted what earlier was said in that audio about the Americans supplying targeting information to Saudi forces who are bombing. Where does America get a lot of its targeting information in this part of the world? The Southern Asia and the Middle East, from PANGAP. PANGAP is critical in supplying that sort of information. So we're already involved in the war because of our alliance with the United States. Note also, though, the Saudi haven't got a good public relations. They are a medievalist state in many ways. Israel is bad enough. Israel's apartheid treatment of the Palestinians, illegal settlements in the West Bank, and murderous bombardment of the Gaza Strip are well known. But in 2016, the Saudi-led coalition in Yemen was added to the UN Secretary General's list of shame for children in armed conflict for its role in killing and maiming children and attacking schools and hospitals in Yemen. Domestically, in Saudi Arabia itself, non-lethal crimes including adultery, armed robbery, apostasy, that is resiling from Sunni Muslim beliefs, drug-related offences, rape, and witchcraft and sorcery are often punished by execution in Saudi Arabia. Now, why that's important, apart from revulsion at it, is that recently there's been some puff pieces in the Western media, including in Australia, trying to present Crown Prince Salman as a moderate, trying to sweep away some of these medievalist elements. But as that audio pointed out, he is directly responsible and primarily responsible for the war in Yemen. So the fact that he may have allowed women to drive in Saudi Arabia compared to killing hundreds of thousands and maybe millions in Yemen, I'm not sure those two things balance. The New York Times and the British Guardian have both been involved in doing these puff pieces, and Guardian Australia has put it out as well. That reliable spokesperson for U.S. Imperialism, Thomas Friedman, has been involved in it. He did a very favorable report on Saudi Arabia recently, and particularly Salman. But so was The Guardian. In fact, they're almost competing with each other. And the whole argument about corruption in Saudi Arabia is, yeah, one person's corruption drives another person's seizure of power. That's a dubious argument to make, but it's required because it'd be very difficult to for the United States to go directly to war with on behalf of Saudi Arabia without some presentation of Saudi Arabia as improving and as taking a better position. So they're necessary, and these sorts of things happen. So Friedman's talking about the most significant reform process underway anywhere in the Middle East today is in Saudi Arabia. So all the other Arab Spring movements failed miserably when they were happening from bottom up. The Saudi one is led from the top down by bin Salman. Friedman didn't ask things like bin Salman spending $500 million on a yacht recently, or the cost of the last vacation in Morocco, where he and his father's royal household spent $950 million on a vacation. So much to combat corruption, Mr. Friedman. So this is the sort of thing that Australia is getting itself involved in. We're involved because of the alliance with the United States, and I'm going to talk a bit more about that after we have some music. I think the other thing worth pointing out here is some of the evidence for the Israeli-Saudi warmongering against Iran and Hezbollah. The growing coordination between them was revealed a few weeks ago when Israeli Channel 10 published a leaked diplomatic cable sent to the Israeli missions abroad, in which they were urged to do everything possible to ramp up pressure against Hezbollah and Iran. The report was reproduced by several news websites. It's reported that the cable was sent to all Israeli ambassadors throughout the world concerning the chaotic events that unfolded over the weekend in Lebanon and Saudi Arabia, i.e. the kidnapping of Lebanese Prime Minister Saad Hariri. The report says that the classified embassy cable written in Hebrew constitutes the first formal evidence, plenty of other informal evidence, proving that the Saudis and Israelis are deliberately coordinating to escalate the situation in the Middle East. The leaked cable requested all Israeli diplomats worldwide to do everything possible to ramp up diplomatic pressure against Hezbollah and Iran. It urged support for Saudi Arabia's war against Iran-backed Houthis in Yemen, and it also stressed that Iran was engaged in regional subversion. So we're talking about quite a systematic approach from Israel. And recently, the Syrian ambassador to India, Riyad Kamal Abbas, during an exclusive interview with the Indian news service APN, revealed that Saudi Arabia's Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman had recently visited Israel. And this was confirmed by Israel's state-funded Kol Yisrael radio service. The secret visit was an abnormal development because the kingdom, as I said, does not even recognize the existence of the Jewish state. Now, it's important to stress that the trigger for a lot of this heightened war escalation is the situation in Syria, where the forces backed by Saudi Arabia and also by Israel, the Islamic State and Al-Qaeda, are virtually defeated. So that method of turning back what they see as the Iran alliance has not worked. That's pretty obvious militarily. So they turn to another one. And Israel have long wanted to get revenge for their defeat in attacking Hezbollah and southern Lebanon in 2006 when they destroyed most of the infrastructure of the region and dropped enormous numbers of cluster bombs and killed many, many people. But after 33 days, had to give up and return to Israel because they couldn't defeat Hezbollah. So that's part of it. Another part of it is that that failed war is the only time Israeli forces have been engaged in any serious military ventures, killing lots of Palestinians, of course, in West Bank, and bombarding Gaza, but as far as a serious military confrontation, it hasn't happened for many, many years. Whereas the both Hezbollah and the Syrian forces are battle-hardened, and so they're worried about that as well, about their chances. And, of course, the myth of Israeli military superiority, it's very important to them, and they have to maintain that image, even if it's not the reality. So let's get back finally to the Australian involvement in this. I already pointed out one of them, which is the Pine Gap one. As an ally of the United States, we Australian Navy has been involved for some years in so-called anti-pirate patrols in the Persian Gulf, Arabian Sea region, against supposedly Somali pilots, pirates. Sorry, and but it's also involved with the Americans, a counter to Iranian naval forces coming out of the Persian Gulf. We are also involved in ongoing training exercises with the Saudi Navy. And this year it's taking place in the region right next to where they are enforcing the blockade against Yemen. So whether Australia is actually in themselves engaged in that blockade is not clear. But the sort of things that may be coming in to Yemen or may be attempted to come in from various places are exactly the sorts of things, including drugs, medical drugs among them, that are part of the anti-pirate activity. So it's quite possible that Australia is already involved in that murderous war. And it's a war that involves, I think it should be clear from the audio we told you, with war crimes. So it leads to the possibility of Australian Navy in the future being accused of war crimes against the Yemeni people. As again, as I stress, one of the poorest countries in the world. I'm with raging cholera epidemic and starvation at rise in this. So this is very serious. This is not to be treated as something distant. We are part of it, and we are involved in it. And how much we're involved in it is not clear at this stage. But remember the terms of the U.S. alliance, if you will. That's the U.S. alliance is based on the idea that Australia. Goes where the Americans need political cover. And in return, the US might support Australia in some possible future conflicts. That's what brought Australia to the Iraq invasion. It brought Australia to bombing missions in Syria and to so many other wars before that. Now, just in case you think it's just me that's pointing out the problems with Australian involvement here. The aid organizations who were bringing aid into Yemen have also spoken out about this issue. So Elaine Pearson, Director of Human Rights Watch in Australia, said, "I think it's disturbing to hear that the ADF, Australian Defence Forces, is training a navy that is involved in this blockade. We know that the Saudi-led coalition has been arbitrarily delaying and diverting ships carrying life-saving goods to Yemen, and humanitarian assistance is clearly desperately needed right now." Another organisation that's spoken out about this is Oxfam in Australia. And there's another element to it as well. Some weeks ago, Defence Industry Minister Christopher Pyne was also spruiking arms sales to the Saudis. What creates their most pressing need for arms in Saudi Arabia? Well, the Yemen war. So Australia's ethics-free refugee policy seemingly also applies to military sales. We'll sell to anyone. And given this state is where they're talking about the defence state, you remember, the military-industrial complex is being built here. This is part of the process of aiding the Saudis, and without any attempt to look at what they're doing and why they're doing. And it all comes because we're a one-sided relationship with the United States. We need an independent foreign policy that allows Australia to stand at its own 2 feet and not be anyone's deputy sheriff. Recently, a new peace group has been formed that I'm a convener of in Adelaide. It's the Independent and Peaceful Australia Network, South Australia, which is an affiliate of IPAN, the Independent and Peaceful Australia Network, National Coalition. We're going to be doing some work soon. In fact, next Thursday, there is a nuclear peace meeting at the Hawke Centre at the Uni West campus of University of South Australia, and we're going to be giving out some leaflets there about this war threat and about the new group. So that's Wednesday. That's Thursday evening at the Hawke Centre. We'll be outside, not inside. That's what we'll be doing. We can promote the group further, because the last thing Australia needs now is involvement in any more wars. The final thing to say is that, in line with some of the things that I've talked about in the past, this is there's a common theme joining the three protagonists of this possible war: the US, Saudi Arabia, and Israel, which is a frustration and a sense of desperation despite the money and power. And that leads to a willingness to take more risks for higher stakes. We've seen that in relation to North Korea, and that situation is still on the boil. We've seen it in relation to Syria, where a direct confrontation between the United States and Russia has not been far away, whether through Hillary Clinton's policy of a no-fly zone in Syria from a year or so ago, or through Trump's work there. I mean, he's made some attempts to build relationships with Russia, but the Democratic leadership and the Republican leadership have been stymieing what there is that, and continuing this false narrative of Russia controlling the election in the US. I mean, it's just farcical, the amount of the lack of evidence that they came up with for that. But still, this process goes on, and the situation that these three countries is in is that they're losing. They're losing economically, they're losing politically, and they're afraid of losing militarily, which Saudi Arabia already is in the Yemen, or at least stalemated. What they will do to counter that, it's hard to tell. So that's it for me this week, not sure if we'll see. I'll talk to you again before Christmas, but I'm going to be podcasting this show, so be available to you.